As you may have read in my most recent column for our monthly newsletter, The Unison, I was recently asked to preach a sermon for a group of UU ministers as part of the annual Harpers Ferry Ministerial Study Group, which oddly enough is not in Harpers Ferry, it's in Berkeley Springs, but that's a story for another day. I ended that sermon with two quotes that many people told me afterwards really resonated with them. So I invite you to hear them now, since they may be especially appropriate at the beginning of a new year. The first quote is from the Roman Catholic monk Thomas Merton, who was both a contemplative, cloistered away in a monastery, and an activist who was heavily involved with corresponding and meeting in person with those who had come to visit him, many of whom were at the forefront of creating social change in the 1960s. And in his book, Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, he wrote a passage that may be particularly appropriate for Unitarian Universalists and other social progressives who are committed to increasing social, economic, environmental, and other forms of justice in this world. And according to Merton, there's a pervasive form of modern violence to which the idealist most easily succumbs. Activism and overwork. The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of its innate violence. To allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything, is to succumb to violence. The frenzy of the activist neutralizes his or her work because it kills the root of inner wisdom, which makes the work fruitful. I find at least two parts of that quote particularly salient. First, that a social activist's right and admirable commitment to social justice can itself become disordered, to the extent that instead of creating more peace and justice, it unintentionally becomes a form of violence, injustice, against one's own well-being due to the stress and overcommitment. Moreover, the frenzy of that work, of that activism, all, you know, desired for good causes, can even more tragically undercut the fruit of that work, in Merton's words, because it kills the root of inner wisdom that helps you discern what really will affect social change and what won't have what some people call the law of unintended consequences. In other words, overcommitment can lead us to do many things poorly instead of a few things with excellence. Related to Merton's concerns of activism and overwork, the second quote that I shared in my sermon at that Harper's Ferry meeting was from the book Listening Hearts, Discerning Call in Community. And it says, "Even when a need exists, and we are well qualified to meet it, we are not necessarily called to respond to it. Something may seem logical for us to do, but that doesn't mean we are called to do it. Simply because a task or an undertaking is good to do does not mean that we are called to do it or that we should continue doing it. To be doing good can be the greatest obstacle to doing something even better." The final line of that quote seems especially significant to me. To be doing good can be the greatest obstacle to doing something even better. As I learned in a class a few years ago on discernment, one of the most basic parts of practicing discernment is learning to choose good over evil. And they're usually that distinct, good over evil. Although in some of the most pressing social concerns of our day, good and evil can seem frustratingly intertwined. There's often, though, a clear difference we can learn between, for example, wrath, greed, sloth, pride, lust, envy, and gluttony, versus wisdom, justice, generosity, persistence, peace, compassion, and humility. Now, I'm playing here on the so-called seven deadly sins and seven virtues, but I could just as easily have drawn from the 10 qualities that lead to Buddhahood: generosity, renunciation, wisdom, strength, effort, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. Over the 10 fetters: self-identity, doubt, clinging, craving, ill will, attachment, comparison, restlessness, and ignorance. Now, I'm not saying that it's always easy to choose good over evil. Instead, I'm saying that that quote we considered earlier, that to be doing good can be the greatest obstacle to doing something even better, challenges us to see that the much more subtle distinction of choosing the best over the better, over the good, that good, best, better can be much more subtle and challenging than choosing simply good and evil. And choosing the best, choosing what is most authentically ours to do, choosing the path that in Friedrich Buechner's words is in that intersection of where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. That choice is a much harder discernment and commitment than simply choosing the good over the bad. And allowing ourselves to do 1,000 good things can distract us from the more fulfilling and ultimately more productive choice of doing a few things that we are most authentically gifted and able to do well. The question then becomes discerning, what is authentically and life-givingly mine to do? And what is authentically mine not to do? Because both saying yes and saying no with intention and with integrity are important spiritual practices. That being said, allow me to add one more twist to the equation. What this perspective is calling us toward is more than being less busy. While yes, on one level, it is about avoiding too many distractions, as our Unitarian forebear Thoreau says in Walden, our life is often frittered away in detail. An honest man has hardly need to count more than his 10 fingers, or in extreme cases, he may add his 10 toes and lump the rest. Simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I say, let your affairs be 2 or 3, not 100 or 1,000. Instead of 1,000,000, count 6 and keep your accounts on your thumbnail. On the other hand, I believe we're called to do more than just simplify and find ourselves less busy. We're called to seek what philosophers call human flourishing, what Jesus called the abundant life. Let me give you an example. This summer, as part of the long process of coming into full fellowship with the Unitarian Universalist Association, I was required to complete a unit of clinical pastoral education. Some of you have heard about this from me. I required driving to Rockville for a class twice a week for 10 weeks, which all total amounted to the equivalent of about 2.5 weeks total stacked on top of the 40-plus work week that I do here at UUCF. And as you've heard me say before, I found CPE to be about 30% helpful and 100% required. And I shared the good part of that 30% last November in a sermon that's available in our sermon archive called After Trauma and Loss, What Not to Say. But my emphasis for this morning is the opposite of the point of that sermon. As grateful as I am for the 30% of that program that was tremendously valuable, being required to spend the summer, which is my favorite season, the opposite of right now, working overtime to complete a program that I found to be 70% a waste of my time was really enervating. I almost always left the CPE classroom feeling drained of energy, sometimes even resentful and angry. On one level, of course, I was aware, as the Buddha teaches, that I was indeed contributing to my own suffering. But on another level, I was reacting to what felt like a legitimate waste of my time that was 100% required. Fortunately, I forced myself to have an attitude adjustment about a third of the way through, and then again about halfway through, that helped me persevere. But consider this comparison. Not long after CPE ended last summer, I found that in the fall, I had overcommitted myself of my own choosing that was not 100% required. I 100% chose it. I had overcommitted myself for a brief period of about 6 weeks in a way that was much more than I had anticipated beforehand. For 6 weeks, starting in mid-October, I was preaching here on Sunday morning, teaching a class on banned books of the Bible at Frederick Community College on Mondays, and teaching Building Your Own Theology here on Tuesdays. That was 3 major presentations I had to prepare each week in a row on top of all the other stuff that's just regular and ongoing. But here's the important part. I was even busier during that 6-week period this fall than during the 10 weeks that I did CPE. But internally, the workload couldn't have felt more differently. Whereas CPE left me feeling disconnected, disgruntled, drained of energy, the back-to-back-to-back preaching and teaching this fall left me tired but in a good way, a well-earned rest after a good and fulfilling week, which didn't mean on Wednesday I didn't spend some quality time on my sofa. It just means that it's a very different internal sensation. One term that comes to mind to describe the difference is what Marx called alienated labor. Marx meant a lot by that term that we can talk about at another time, including the negative consequences of workers not being in control of the means of production. Are you supposed to pound, like, means of production? I think you're, whenever you say that. But for this morning, that term alienated labor also points toward work that we're forced to do that does not employ our autonomy, our creativity, and our gifts, and that leaves us feeling enervated instead of energized. To connect this dynamic back to the question of what is yours to do and not to do in this new year, one of my favorite metaphors for discernment, as you've heard me say this before, it's swimming with and against the current of a river. And I found over and over the past few years that resolutions that are too far outside my wheelhouse, such as for me completing that CPE unit this summer or taking guitar lessons, trying to improvise on the guitar, it feels like swimming against the current of a river. No matter how much effort I exert, how hard I swim, I make little or no progress and I end up frustrated and exhausted. But with other projects that are comparatively much harder, allegedly, and require much more work, such as preaching and teaching this fall, or completing a doctoral degree, finishing a triathlon, that feels to me like I'm swimming with the current, and I can feel myself moving rapidly through the currents, even if it's a long swim. And in the end, I'm left feeling more invigorated than exhausted. And since this Sunday, today is Twelfth Night, the 12th day of Christmas in the Christian tradition, allow me to give one further example. Christmas importantly commemorates the birth of Jesus, but one of the reasons that I transferred and felt drawn to transfer from liberal Christianity to Unitarian Universalism, of which liberal Christianity is still a part, is that I think it's unhelpful to focus our religious and spiritual life too much on one historical male individual. Instead, I see Jesus as one among many prophetic figures who should inspire us. Moreover, I ultimately think that the historical Jesus would agree with me that in the end, the point is not imitating the life of any one individual, it's building what Martin Luther King Jr. called the beloved community. Said differently, I think that Rabbi Jesus would agree with the old Hasidic rabbi, Rabbi Zusha, who on his deathbed said, "In the world to come, I shall not be asked, why were you not Moses? I shall be asked, why were you not Zusha?" So in this new year, the question is more than, why were you not Moses or Miriam, Jesus or Gandhi, Buddha or MLK? The question is, who are you? Why were you not yourself? Where does your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet? What is most authentically yours to do? Not just the many good things to do, which can be a distraction, but the best. Those activities, practices, people, and places and things which can make manifest your best self. What is yours to do in 2014? What makes you come alive? And what is yours not to do that you may push away those distractions and make manifest your best self? As we continue to live into this discernment, because it's a lifelong process, both individually and as a congregation, I invite you to rise in body or spirit as we sing together the first two verses, just verses 1 and 2 of Fire of Commitment. As you continue to reflect on what is yours to do and not to do in this new year, I invite you to consider two different ritual responses that are part of a tradition in Unitarian Universalism known as Fire Communion. At the front of the sanctuary, there are two tables with paper, pens, and votive candles. And if there's something you feel led to say no to let go of, I invite you in a few moments to come forward and write a word or phrase on a slip of paper, maybe just a brief symbol that's symbolic to you of that thing that you feel called to let go of. And then I invite you to light that slip of paper on fire and to drop it in the bowl at the center of the table. And to be clear, this ritual of burning, incinerating the thing you want to let go of, that doesn't actually mean that your process of letting go of it is complete. I'll let you in on a secret. But I invite you to see this ritual as potentially an important gesture Intention is really important. It can be an important gesture, perhaps one step among many, of your intention to continue to try to let go of that part of your life that in the past has been life-negating for you. And to not set off fire alarms and call the fire inspector, we do have a little help from magic. So when you light it, it will go quickly. It should not burn you. If you feel that you want to light it over the table, do so. You can kind of toss it up. Don't toss it at your neighbor. I think it would probably still be okay, but let's do practice proper safety. You're also invited to light a votive candle to symbolize something that you want to do or to affirm or to say yes to in the new year. And let's maybe light the inside votive candles first so we aren't like reaching over votive candles. So light from the inside to the outside. So as the music begins playing in a few moments, you're invited to come forward as you feel led to do so, to do either of both of these rituals. Though go ahead and come forward. You know, don't be shy. Go ahead and come forward pretty rapidly. And to help with your discernment, though, I'll leave you with a... Hold on. The music hasn't started yet. Not that rapidly, people. All right. You're ready to go. Let's get some resolutions started. No, hold on. No. So to help with your discernment, I want to leave you with a series of questions that we were given as part of this Choose Health pilot program that I mentioned during the spoken meditation. We were asked to reflect on what is authentically ours to do in seven areas, and maybe this will trigger maybe some of the seven, an area or so that you want to work on in the new year. May these questions help prompt your discernment of what is yours to let go of and affirm in the new year. Very quickly. The first is physical wellness. When and how do you feel physically alive and skillfully engaged with your body? And what would you like to do to feel this way more often? Physical wellness. Emotional wellness. When or how do you feel emotionally engaged? Let yourself dream about something that would add more joy to your life. Emotional wellness. Intellectual wellness. When and how does your mind feel energized and buzzing with electric vitality? Financial wellness. What would help you feel more comfortable with your finances? Intellectual wellness, financial wellness. Social wellness. When or how do you feel connected, grateful, and loved? And how can you find more of that in the new year? Vocational wellness. How and when do you feel fulfilled and optimistic in your work? And spiritual wellness, what makes you feel fully alive and connected to the larger world, what we UUs call the interdependent web of all existence. So now, as the music starts playing, you're invited to come forward, write a word or phrase or symbol on a slip of paper that you're called to let go of and light a votive candle to symbolize something you want to say yes to in the new year.